A very warm welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me today is editor Simon Lambert and development editor Rich Browning to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And this week, we lift the roof on the property market. Simon asked just how much should we be worried about it? 90% of homeowners reckon prices will rise in the next 6 months, but less than a fifth plan to sell. It's as estate agents say, the number of listed properties for sale is closing on record lows as it is. In one area of the country, you need 17 times the average salary to buy. The number of under 35-year-olds still living with their folks has gone up a third. We ask, are tiny homes the way to go? Yes, David Cameron, we are eyeing up your writing shed. And also, we'll take a look at plans to introduce an energy cap from the Tories. How different is it really to the much-derided plan of Ed Miliband back in 2013? But first, the question we all wanted to know could have been answered this week.
Now, our six pledges form the basis of our plan for working people. These six pledges are now carved in stone. They're carved in stone because they won't be abandoned after the general election.
Thought extinct, but no. Some good news this week has celebrity adventurer Ben Fogel found the lesser spotted Ed Stone. Simon, we were talking about this only the other week on the show. Has it been found?
Well, this makes me like to think that celebrity adventurer Ben Fogel, when he's not celebrity adventuring, is listening to the This Is Money podcast.
I think so.
And that he was inspired after our discussion about the Ed Stone, which you said that you had completely forgotten about.
Yep.
And I think many people had completely forgotten about, that he was inspired by this to go out searching for said Ed Stone. Although apparently he may have just spotted it while he was out for dinner one evening.
I was going to say, where was that? In the Outer Hebrides?
Bizarrely, I think it was in a garden somewhere in West London, somewhere near a restaurant, hidden behind some foliage. Now, whether this is the real Ed Stone, a fake Ed Stone, or whether it's just Ed Stone Gate, we don't really know. But I was under the impression, though, that one of the last stories I'd read about it was that they'd smashed it to pieces.
That was possibly wishful thinking. I think this is a mission for Lee Boyce to send out and to find out whether this is the real Ed Stone. Rich, what do you think?
I'd like to think if I was a celebrity adventurer, I'd adventure myself to a place better than somebody's front garden to find a gravestone.
Yeah.
Let's call it a gravestone.
Just imagine, and when I was reading this story, thought, I bet you all the policy advisors were sitting around chatting away as you do, going, right, we've got this manifesto pledges. I think there were six of them, weren't there? What should we do with them? I know, carve them in stone. And someone went, yeah, literally, should we do it? As a bit of a joke. But actually, they really did do it. I think we should take a moment to remember that they actually carved it in what was essentially looked like, didn't it? A gravestone, Rich.
Yes. It was a giant stone tablet, basically. And the idea was that they would carve these pledges into this giant stone tablet to show quite how serious they were about making these pledges. Yeah. Unfortunately, nobody had the sense to point out that they would actually just look really stupid and then just become a sort of internet meme. However, a man connected with the company, I think, that made the slab, Steve Van Hisberg, co-owner of Stone Circle, said the slab was unlikely to have been strong and stable enough to be installed in the restaurant garden. Mr. Van Hisberg, this is according to The Telegraph, who said he was previously under a non-disclosure agreement, said, I'm 99% sure it's smashed. It was not returned here, but I know it was smashed because I know the man who smashed it. The original was too big. It was 3 metres tall. You could not lift it without a crane. It was 400 kilograms. You have to handle it like a pane of glass. It will fold up. Like with all marble and stone, you have to treat it very carefully.
You learn something new every day, Simon. Right, well, we're going to move on to more loftier subjects, though, I think. Still policy-related, not carved into stone, as I understand it. What I love about that clip, by the way, is you can hear someone laughing in the background when he's announcing that. Either that or it's a cough. I think it's a laugh. Yes, so Ed Miliband, in the news a fair bit this week, has Theresa May announced a resurrection of one of the former Labour leader's policies, planning a cap on some gas and electricity prices if she's re-elected. Reporter Adam Lindsay has more.
Nothing less than a price freeze will do.
That was the promise made by Ed Miliband. Now it seems the Conservatives agree. But Lib Dem former Cabinet Minister Ed Davey says his Tory colleagues were critical back then.
The current Defence Secretary described this very policy as dangerous and said it would hit investment.
Business Secretary Greg Clark says there's a key difference between their policy and Labour's.
The Independent Competition Authority made an investigation into the energy markets, and they found that consumers were overpaying by £1.4 billion a year. And that's ranged in the past from about £70 a year to £200 a year on people's bills. Ed Miliband's policy would have been a disastrous policy because he said he was going to introduce a price freeze. Almost as soon as he made that pledge, energy prices started to fall around the world, so people would have been paying more than is needed. So what we are saying is it should be a cap for those standard variable tariffs, the default poor value tariff, so that people don't pay more than what the Competition Authority said is justified. It'll be set not by ministers, but by the independent regulator.
Energy firms believe the move could actually push up prices for consumers.
Claire Osborne is energy expert at the comparison site YouSwitch.
I certainly think it's a good thing that the government is focused on bringing down prices for energy customers. With a third of working families struggling to pay their bills at the moment, that's really important. But the risk is with this policy that it actually won't bring down prices. The risk is that it removes competition, and that's the effect that does bring down prices, and that we could see prices rise as a result. The Competition and Markets Authority did a two-year study on this topic and concluded that a range of measures needed to be implemented. They considered a price cap and explicitly did not put that forward as a suggestion. And we've seen some really, really good moves in the energy industry recently in terms of competition. We've seen about 25 new energy suppliers enter the market, and we've seen the market share of the big six dominant players shrink by about 14%. And that's good news. That's consumers switching away from standard variable tariffs to cheap deals that are fixed and protect them from future price rises. And what's important about that is the threat of consumers voting with their feet, working to keep suppliers keeping their prices low for all UK consumers.
OK, so good or bad for consumers, for competition, we'll get into that in more detail. But Simon, I do want to ask you, lots of derision around this for Theresa May, given that it's quite similar to Ed Miliband's plan in 2013. David Cameron actually said at the time, "I know we'd like to live in some sort of Marxist universe where you can control all these things, but he needs a basic lesson in economics." So does the current Prime Minister need a basic lesson in economics, or is this a good thing?
Well, I think that it is worth saying that this is not the same as Ed Miliband's plan. It is, of course, completely different. Anybody who suggests that it bears any similarities whatsoever is completely mistaken. And that is an absolutely outlandish suggestion to be made if I was trotting out the lines of Conservative Party Central. Which I'm not. So it looks suspiciously like Ed Miliband's promise. Yeah. But there is actually a difference. So Ed Miliband talked about price freeze. And it is true to say that he did talk about price freeze and then prices fell. And one of the things that was raised at the time when he said an energy price freeze was, what if prices fall? You will have just locked them in at the higher level. Now, presumably someone, possibly not the person in charge of carving things onto giant stones, but someone in Ed Miliband's organisation and you know, supporters with half a brain would have written in to the proposed freeze that if energy prices did fall, they had to come down. But if they went up, they couldn't go up. At which point, when it was implemented, if Ed Miliband had been elected, it would have looked a lot more like a cap than a freeze. So it might be slightly disingenuous to say, you know, that these things are completely different because one's a cap and one's a freeze, because I like to think that someone would have had the brain cells to write in, if energy prices fell, then they would fall rather than just stay the same. But what they're saying is basically, we've tried to get all these people to switch their energy bills. A chunk of people do, and they save lots of money. And the people who are essentially paying for those people to save lots of money are the people who just sit on their standard variable rate energy tariffs. Some of them we can probably just lambast for not bothering to save themselves money and that they should probably just pull their fingers out. They use the internet enough on a daily basis and it only takes 5 minutes to check who's the cheapest energy supplier in your postcode. Go to thisismoney.com/energy-bills and you can literally do it there in a few minutes. But there is also a chunk of people who maybe they're not internet savvy. The older people, the more vulnerable people. We've talked about this before and we said, hey, look, if you know a friend or a relative who you think fits into that bracket and is exactly the kind of person who probably would never go and compare their energy bills, maybe because they are a bit, you know, less internet savvy, go do it for them. Go help them out. Go save your friend or your relative £300. do it for them this weekend. They'll thank you for it. You know, so you could try and encourage that kind of behaviour. But instead, what the government has come up with is some form of cap on these standard variable rate tariffs that's going to be decided by Ofgem. So that's the other difference they're saying, is that it would be decided by the regulator, not by politicians. Again, you would think that if Miliband had got elected, some bright spark would have said, let's not have the politicians setting the prices or the cap here or the freeze here. Let's actually get the experts to do it. So it's not clear how different this would have been. But you would like to think that they could at least do something about the standard variable rates and the energy companies charging all this money.
Did the Competition and Markets Authority not look into this situation a couple of months ago and say that a cap wasn't necessary? So what's the point in getting regulators involved if some of them don't think it's necessary?
It's a difficult scenario because, to be honest, the energy market is a bit of a mess. And we seem torn between trying to allow the free market to sort things out and intervening to try and sort things out ourselves. And we don't seem to be able to decide as a nation whether we want to do one or the other, and frequently appear to change our minds. So it's not surprising that you end up with this weird scenario that you just described, where the CMA says one thing and then the government says another thing. I think there is definitely a truth in the element that this could make things less competitive at the sharp end of all the cheaper tariffs, the companies competing to offer the cheaper tariffs, because there'll be less incentive for people to switch. If there's less people switching, then they won't feel compelled to offer these cheaper tariffs. There'll be a bit less competition. But I think we're so far down the road of people switching energy. And also, I think we're so far down the road of new energy companies coming in that actually people would probably continue to switch, because it's not just, you know, it's really easy not to get energy from the big six. There's loads of other companies out there. You can choose a very small one you've never heard of, or you can choose a smaller one that you have heard of. You can choose one that will only do you green electricity, and one that will promise to try and do you green gas as well. You can choose one that ploughs all its profits back into your local area. And there's one that's being set up in Manchester, trying to use the profits they have to invest into sort of charity endeavours and making life better for people around the world, people who are, you know, impoverished in other countries. So there's all kinds of things you can do. It's just about getting people to do them. And I think the real struggle we have is that there is just a chunk of people who can't be bothered.
Is it the majority of people? I think people just aren't interested enough. They just like see this as something that they have to pay, set aside an amount of money, and whether it's a bit over that, then they're just not bothered. And it is.
And time passes pretty quickly. You know, these standard variable rate deals. So say you've signed up to a new energy provider, which I did a few couple of years back. I signed up with OVO. And you fixed for 1 year. Well, that year went pretty quickly. It didn't seem to take very long before I got an email from them saying, your fix is coming to an end. What do you want to do? And I just thought, oh, I've got to do this again. So I think there is that inertia and that lack of engagement that Rich says.
It's just because the savings aren't enough. I know I'll probably switch more than anybody, but I probably won't do it again because I found the small little green provider that does the electricity from renewables. And that I feel quite smug about that. And I pay more than the big six, but there's none of the aggro that you get with the big six with bills that don't quite add up because they're really complicated. I know it's been simplified now, but I can phone up my company and they sort of like almost on first name terms, or it's that small.
But the message is, I suppose, getting through. We passed the 500,000 mark for switchers just last month, and that's up 14% compared to April 2016. So the message is getting through. And actually, you can save a fair whack, and we'll be talking about that in a minute. But I do want to know, competition or not, whether consumers will see better deals or not, does it inevitably look like we're going to get some sort of price cap coming in? I mean, you could probably argue the Conservatives have this election in the bag. But we heard earlier this week as well, Simon raising his eyebrows there, a leaked Labour draft manifesto. So on energy, they'd have at least one publicly owned supplier in every region of the country, with the government controlling the transmission and distribution grids. And they would introduce an immediate emergency price cap of £1,000 a year. So we're going to get some intervention in the energy market, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's highly unlikely that in the what looks like highly unlikely scenario that Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, that he wouldn't in some way cap energy prices. So, yes, it looks like we are going to get some form of an energy price cap, whatever happens.
But it's probably not worth waiting for that to come in. It's probably worth switching around if you haven't already, especially as we're being warned to take action now. As many as 600,000 households face a leap in their energy bills. They face average increases of £333. That's if they let their provider automatically roll them onto an expensive standard variable rate tariff. That's according to research by Compare the Market. Now, last month, 30 popular tariffs ended. We've got a further 40 tariffs due to end before the end of June. So get online. Is that the message, Rich? Or help out your friends and family?
Well, the problem with this country is we all have to be in heated homes because it gets quite cold and wet and damp. So it's quite a strange flagship policy, perhaps, but if you can switch and want to save some money, there is money to be saved if you haven't switched before.
Why are so many tariffs ending at the moment? Just that time of year?
Well, no. If you cast your mind back a couple of years back, quite a lot of them, these 2-year tariffs or 18-month tariffs or 1-year tariffs. Cast your mind back a bit further than that to when this whole argument about energy prices first erupted, going back 3 or 4 years now, before energy prices fell. And what you saw was a reaction to that was a lot of extra fixed price tariffs being introduced. So lots more companies doing fixed price tariffs and lots of entrants to the market, because this desire to try and get small energy companies into the market has, you know, worked. And actually, it's pretty easy to set up an energy company. We've discussed this before on the show. Essentially, you're not producing any energy. You're not taking any energy to anybody's home. You're kind of just a middleman. You know, if you imagine you've got your customer here with a sort of plug here, and you've got your energy here with a socket here, you are literally the person who picks up the customer, unplugs them from their existing supplier, plugs them into their new thing, and off you go. And nothing changes with their power. It's just you're effectively now managing the power that they have. You collect the money, you pay the supply. You're buying the energy on the wholesale markets. So you've got all these little firms, and all of these little firms have kicked off a lot of their business around fixed tariffs. And that's actually quite good news for them, because they know how much money they're going to be getting in rather than the money that they're coming in bouncing around all the time with energy prices. So that's why there's been what seems like a lot more of these fixed rate energy deals expiring, is because over the last 3-4 years, we've just introduced a whole lot more of them to the system.
Now let's turn our attention to the property market. We got a swathe of, well, rather mixed data out this week. It's prompted Simon to get out his laptop, to tap away and ask, how worried should we really be about it? House prices are near record levels when compared to wages. In fact, in Hackney in London, you'll need 17 times your average salary to buy a home. It's not just London either. In Purbeck, in Dorset, apparently that figure is 14 times your average salary. Now, estate agents say the number of properties listed for sale is closing in on record lows, and the number of under 35-year-olds still living with their parents has gone up by a third to 1.2 million. But first-time buyer figures, well, they look okay. They're on the up. And according to Halifax, house prices suffered their first ever quarterly fall for nearly 5 years, with more homes going for below their asking prices. Here's Martin Ellis, housing economist at Halifax.
If you look at house prices over the past 3 months, then they've really ground to a halt at a UK national level, February to April, and prices are slightly down on the preceding 3 months, just a small fall, 0.2%. And also, if we look at the annual rate, that's now come down to just below 4%, at 3.8% in April. And just over a year ago, back in March 2016, that peaked at 10.0%. So there's been a marked slowdown in annual house price inflation over the past year. Virtually no change in house prices over the past 3 months. I think this is part of a sustained slowdown that we've now seen going on since well before the EU referendum last year, going back to last spring. And we've seen the market sort of running out of steam after a period of several years when house prices have increased really quite rapidly. People finding it more and more difficult to be able to afford the prices which they need to pay in order to enter the market. As that's been happening, we've been seeing house price growth slow down, particularly in London and the South East and the rest of southern England, whereas the market elsewhere is still sort of going along with some momentum. Young people typically sort of in their 20s, early 30s, when you'd expect they'd be looking to make their first home purchase, now simply can't afford to do so. So yes, we're seeing more people having to return to their parents' property, live there while they have some time and some scope to actually be able to save up, to be able to afford the deposits which they require to get into the market. But you can look outside sort of parts of southern England and the picture is really quite different. And house prices are very much lower. They're certainly lower in relation to earnings and affordability is far less of an issue. And we're now seeing that actually it's West Midlands which is leading the country. That's where we're seeing the biggest house price growth. We're likely to see, I think, that rippling out to parts of northern England sort of over the coming year.
So, Simon, what is the real picture? How worried should we really be? You've written about this. Why have you written about this? Go.
Well, I think that when we think about the property market and we think about the health of the property market, we have a tendency in this country to think in terms of house prices. We think of it very simplistically, as in house prices going up, everything okay. House prices going down, everything bad. And we're at one of those turning points that you get at the moment where there's this question of whether house prices going up are about to turn into house prices going down. If you cast your mind back a year ago, we were talking about all of those warnings that were starting to be bandied around about if you voted for a certain thing, and that thing was Brexit.
Wasn't it 18% fall, some of the figures were predicting?
The world was going to fall apart,
yeah, but
basically.
House prices were going to fall. Yeah, I mean, that's more important than
house prices were going
really
to fall. Yeah. Yes, there was all kinds of warnings being trotted out. This thing that was labelled Project Fear. Well, in the end, we pressed the big red button. We picked Brexit. Mm-hmm. And house prices, well, they kept going up. In fact, we even got an interest rate cut, which sent mortgage rates, which nobody actually believed could get any lower than they already were, to even lower levels, which puts another prop under the property market. And the Bank of England bunged banks and building societies a bit more money with the idea that they would lend it out to keep lending going. So we gave it another crutch. But things have actually finally started to tail off a little bit. House prices are still going up mm-hmm. annually. In fact, if you look at them on an annual basis, they're still up a considerable number of thousands of pounds compared to where they were a year ago. But the trend, if you look at the change in annual inflation, and also the trend if you look at quarterly inflation, and in fact Halifax came out this week and said that over the quarter house prices have actually fallen for the first time in nearly 5 years, the trend appears to be one of tailing off. So I was anticipating the fact that we are probably going to start getting now any number of stories, potentially if house prices do actually start falling into negative territory, about the housing market being in trouble. And my point was really to look at the state of the housing market and ask, well, actually, those house prices, maybe they're a complete misnomer. They don't mean anything. Maybe the property market is already in trouble, or maybe it isn't.
Well, it depends what you think about in trouble. Trouble yeah. for who? Because a lot of people will think falling house prices is a great thing for them.
Well, exactly. So, and this is again, you know, as a first point on this house prices going up, good thing, house prices going down, bad thing, is that for many people, house prices at least going down by a little bit. If you're a first-time buyer, if you don't own a property, house prices going down would be a good thing. Although, actually, you'll probably find most of your family's wealth is tied up in housing anyway. So, you know, there is a question there.
Yeah.
But if you already own a property, then you would probably likely to think that house prices going down is a bad thing for you. This is because you have a mortgage on that property, and the closer that your property's value gets to the mortgage, the less equity that you have, i.e. the less of the house that is yours, whereas the mortgage amount stays the same. But also because a house is your main asset, and if any of your assets start falling in value, you start to worry about it a bit. But really, you're probably not going to sell that house anyway. Chances are that if your house ends up, you know, down 10%, you're not going to sell it anyway. I mean, it's quite difficult to sell houses. They're not, you know, unlike stock market crashes, people tend to lose money because they basically panic and sell out at the bottom. House price crashes, most people don't tend to lose money because it's very difficult to panic and sell out at the bottom. It involves selling your house and potentially not moving into another one in order to cash in. So people are protected in a way from that. The issue they have is if they suddenly can't pay their mortgage. So, yeah, you've got that element where house prices falling might be a good thing. And if you own a home and you plan on moving to a bigger one, you'd like to move to one with more bedrooms, perhaps, then actually house prices coming down would be a good thing for you, because that next home is probably likely to be more expensive. But just to go back to the general health of the property market, we've got, you know, a number of things that I talked about here. House prices are near record levels when you compare to wages. And that's not just London and the South East. If you compare that across the whole of the country, it is true. Long-term average house prices to wages is just over 4, according to the Nationwide chart. It's now at 6 point something overall for the UK. The peak was only a little bit above that. And you have to bear in mind that the long-run average is actually pulled up by the massive peak in the 2000s boom. But then also you've got this scenario where the amount of money that we spend on mortgage interest is roughly in line with the long run average and actually above the long run average in London and the South East. Yet that's at a time when mortgage rates have never, ever been as low as they are now. So they're at record lows, yet we're still spending out as much money every month on our mortgage payments. And then, of course, there's the issue that if you want to get one of those mortgages or buy one of those properties, you're going to need a deposit. And sky high prices make raising that deposit very, very, very difficult. If you look at the Council of Mortgage Lenders figures, the average home mover deposit at the moment is £45,000. And the ONS has an annual median wage of £28,000. So you would need to save 160% of an entire year's pre-tax wages to get that deposit. Mm. Go back to 1999, the average deposit was £9,500. And the median wage was £17,800. So you only needed to save 53%. There's a huge difference between needing to save 53% of your year's total earnings for a deposit and 160%. And so we've got this market of haves and have-nots, where a lot of the money that's going into property is cash. That's either coming from wealthier investors, or a lot of it's coming from the bank of mum and dad. £418 of every £1,000 going into property was cash. And I just looked at all this, and I said, you know, it's hard to argue in that scenario that the property market is in good health.
Rich, in good health? Your thoughts?
I'm not sure there's a lot to add there. I would perhaps say that we should remember that we haven't actually Brexited yet.
I was also going to point that out, so well done, Rich.
And that is, I mean, a lot of commentators, even the pro-Brexit commentators, are saying now that we're about to enter this period of uncertainty.
Haven't we been entering that period of uncertainty for quite some time, though?
Oh, but I think we actually are.
Oh, right. This is officially the period of official uncertainty. Yeah, got it.
Well, after the election, we might find out what the plans for Brexit might well be, which, from where I'm sitting, it doesn't look great. I'm not sure there are much room for negotiations. So what that means is, why would you take out this massive mortgage with 160% of your pre-tax income when you just don't know what's going to happen? I mean, people talk about the markets and uncertainty, but it filters right down to everybody.
Well, because renting is not so cheap. But where does Martin Ellis from Halifax think that all this is heading in the next few years?
We do have this quite a split market. And I think we're in danger of having a market where those people who can come in and afford properties are those who actually have fairly well-off parents, those who are able to help out. It's the bank of mum and dad who've got the resources. Maybe a lot of that does come from house price rises in the past, which has built up a big sort of housing equity cushion for them, which they're then able to use to be able to subsidise and help their own children get into the market. But if you're not fortunate enough to be in that sort of position, maybe you don't have parents who own their own home or have actually built up very little equity, then you're not going to be in such a fortunate position. You're going to find it much more of a struggle to be able to afford a home. So I think we are in danger of actually splitting the market that way. And of course, we have had a situation where prices have been supported by a very long period of extremely low mortgage rates. And again, that's helping those people who are able to get hold of fairly large deposits to be able to enter the market. So they need that help from bank of mum and dad to be able to put the deposit together. If they can then jump that hurdle, what we do see is that across most of the country, you're actually going to be better off buying than you are going to be renting. So we're in danger of leaving behind a lot of people who can't afford their own home. Well, I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a period of more modest house price growth. We've seen house price growth in annual terms falling to just below 4% now. We think by the end of this year, it's likely to be slightly lower than that. So actually, we could see sort of house prices rising more slowly than general inflation during the course of this year. And that would be the first time for many years. And that might make things slightly easier if we see this period of more subdued house price growth. It makes it more easy for potential first-time buyers to be able to sort of build up a bit in terms of savings, without thinking, oh, I'm forever chasing sharply escalating house prices and it's not helping, I can't save enough and I'll never be able to save enough. So I think we could get into a period of sort of more stability, which would actually help a lot of people being able to get into the market.
Now, Martin Ellis spoke earlier about the problem for renters. We got a warning from the charity Shelter that people in Britain are being driven into debt in order to keep a roof over their heads. Now, a third of low earners have had to borrow money to pay their rent, according to government stats. We spoke to Nadine Masseron, who lives in Berkshire with her 16-year-old daughter and has had similar problems.
The rent that I currently pay is over half of my income. I go into debt regularly to not to pay the rent because I can't do that, obviously. It has to go through a bank account, but I use it to pay for everyday household bills and things like that because all my money is going on the rent. I'm a single mum. I have a daughter. I try not to let it impact our life, which is hence why we do go into debt, because I don't see why, because of high rents, she should be deprived of everyday things that she needs at school, to be allowed to go on school trips and things like that. So to be able to afford that on top of rents and things like that, yes, I do have to go into debt to provide her with a normal childhood. Come December, I will take out a credit card and I will max pretty much do everything on that credit card. I will do all my household shopping. I will put money on for the winter fuel bill. I'll pay that in advance. I'll pay all my bills. I'll get the car service. I'll do a rack up a massive debt in 1 month so that we can have not an expensive Christmas, but some sort of Christmas. And that all goes on a big credit card. And then come January, I will do a balance transfer. I'm onto a 0% so I can pay that off during the year. So that will cover fuel bills, car bills, all stuff. I kind of do it all in one go. And then I do know the credit cards are there throughout the year if I need to use them for emergencies. If any emergency comes up, I have no savings. My money all goes on the rent. So if any emergency comes up, I will only have credit cards to get me through.
Shelter also found 800,000 private renters aren't able to save £10 a month. Their head of policy is Kate Webb.
The simple reason is that rents are just far too high in relation to what people are earning. And that means that people who are, you know, who are renting privately are having to really scrape by each month. They're paying a huge proportion of their income to their landlord. As we've seen, they're often having to borrow money to keep up with payments. And we've also found that 800,000 of them can't even afford to save £10 a month. So they're being put in a really precarious situation just because we've allowed wages and rents to get, you know, hideously out of step. Whoever wins the general election has to step in and offer something for these hard-pressed renters. So that's why we're calling for the next government to commit to a new generation of living rent homes, which will be genuinely affordable to people on lower incomes and also give them the stability that they desperately need. And there's a huge number of people who are struggling in that situation. And that's why we think the next government should commit to what is an ambitious target of building 500,000 living rent homes over the course of the next parliament.
Simon, we're so preoccupied, aren't we, with house prices. Sometimes we almost forget about the renters as well, and there's more of them facing increased rents. And there was a time, was there not, when you rented, that was to save money to buy. Gone are those days?
Well, it's very difficult to save the money to buy. I mean, we were talking about the size of a deposit that you need just then. And if your rent is basically eating up more money than you can afford every month, then you're certainly not going to be able to afford to save any money to buy. I think, you know, it is worth commenting that for people for whom high house prices are an issue because they own a property and they'd like to move to a bigger one, and it's impacting their life choices, but, you know, they're able to keep paying out what that property costs because they can afford the mortgage thanks to record low mortgage rates, they are at least in a considerably better position than the person who is basically struggling to make ends meet and can't even pay their rent.
Perhaps we need to think outside the box, or in it. Now, remember the brouhaha about David Cameron spending £25,000 on a shed to write in? But could we see more of these cropping up, not as a place to pen your philosophical missives or indeed the next after-dinner speech, but as a place to live? Not just for hobbits, the tiny house movement is gradually catching on in the UK, so we're being told. More and more people are looking to their gardens to create a bit more living space or temporary accommodation. Good luck to you if you've got a garden to do that. Now, whether it's for a teenager, spare bedroom for family or friends, or a bit of extra B&B space. Now, Rich, one company's caught your eye that provides all this. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, it made me lol.
Lol. Is that laugh out loud?
Laugh out loud when I saw it. Is it Tiny Homes or Tiny Houses or something? Which is basically a shed on a trailer that you can park wherever you like and live.
Does it have shower facilities and like a, just literally think, well, a tiny home?
I mean, these camper van people that will customise a van for you. You can have whatever you like in them. So there's no reason to think you can't have whatever you like in these sheds. But they're wooden chalets that you fit on a trailer that you fill with rubble to take to the tip, as far as I can tell. And I don't think it's going to take off, if I'm really frank.
You never know, Rich. You never know.
I'd love to have a go.
Yeah? How long do you reckon you'd last in a tiny little shed to live in? I don't mean literally last.
I mean, I've lived in rooms in the past. It's not even a studio flat. So, you know, you can survive for a fair while, I think. But novelty homes, I don't think I'd like to stay there for more than a holiday.
We are seeing more variety, though, aren't we? Things like canal boats and other sort of things. Is this the way forward, Simon?
Well, I know a little bit about this whole tiny house thing.
OK.
And this is because I have a friend who is quite interested in this. And actually, he's quite disappointed about the Cameron's purchase of the Shepherd's Hut and the stories that are starting to go around about tiny houses and things like this, because he says, don't tell everyone, you know, it's going to drive the prices up. And the reason why he is thinking about moving into a tiny house is because he can't afford a normal house.
Mm.
So therefore, he's decided that maybe the answer is to get one of these tiny houses and to basically live on someone else's land. And he knows someone whose land that he can live on if he gets this. And there's two elements to this movement going on here. On one side, you've got the Cameron tiny house type thing, which is basically a shepherd's hut, a what would have once been called a garden room or something down the bottom of the garden, a summer house. That's what people used to call it, a summer house down the bottom of the garden. But they're being poshed up a bit. They're being made a bit more fancy. They've got all mod cons and everything like that. It's extra living space, as you said earlier. You know, you can let a guest sleep down there. You can make it your writing studio. You can make it a place for your kids to play. You can't afford to move to a bigger house, so you put something in the garden. The planning rules are fairly relaxed on this kind
well,
of thing. Although there are some planning rules. There are some planning rules. The planning rules are fairly relaxed on it. If you stay within sort of permitted development rights, you don't build something that's too big. And so you could take advantage of that. And whenever there is that scenario that you could maybe do this kind of thing and it's got a bit on trend, there's any number of companies who'd also like to take advantage of this by selling you something really expensive. David Cameron, Shepherd's Hut, £25,000, I'm thinking here. On the other side of this tiny house movement, there are the actual tiny house people. And what they specialise in doing is creating a tiny little house, a living space that caters for all your needs that you could genuinely live in. So you've got, you know, your bed, you've got your kitchen, you've got your cleaning space, so it's a way you can shower and use the bathroom and things like that. And you've maybe got some shelves built in for your books. You've probably got a wood burner, I suspect, in order to keep yourself warm. And that actually people do live in these things. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously, as with everything, I think some of this trend comes from the States. And there is a movement around this. Now, the issue is, of course, you've got your tiny house. You've decided you're going to live in it. You're going to opt out of modern day existence. Where are you going to put it? Because obviously you can't just stick it in a field, and you can't even just buy a field and stick it in the field. You can't even just buy a bit of woodland and stick it in the middle of the woodland hidden. We have rules in this country that are quite tight about where you put your tiny house. And I don't know exactly what the rules are in America about this kind of thing, but I'm willing to guess and maybe even put a small amount of money on that they're probably a lot more relaxed about people putting tiny houses places, and that their planning rules are probably a lot more relaxed about that kind of thing. So whether it can catch on in the same way, I don't know. But you have the same problem with a canal boat. Canal boat sounds like a great idea until you remember that you've got to moor it somewhere.
Really? Well, smell a bit and people kick cans into the canals and all sorts.
Yeah, maybe. You might come home from the pub one night and find that some joker's untied your canal boat and it's drifted off down the river. But I quite like a canal boat. I think they're quite romantic in their way, you know. They're picturesque. You can move around. You've got your own little home in one. They are narrow. That is the dead giveaway about the narrow boat name. Yeah. They are quite narrow. They are quite small.
And they're on the water as well.
Cramped. They're on the water. I quite like the water.
Waves.
But it's the mooring. The mooring does cost you money. And the canal boat as well won't go up in value like a house might do. A canal boat will go down in value. The mooring will cost you money. And there's been a big crackdown in recent years on this thing called continuous cruising. And continuous cruising is where you don't get a mooring and instead you basically say, because you need a license for your boat, and they say, do you have a mooring or are you a continuous cruiser? And you have to say, I'm a continuous cruiser. And then there's rules about that. And they've started cracking down on this, which means that you can't get away with just moving your boat 50 metres down the river, 100 metres down the river, or even just around the corner. And that's what a lot of people used to get away with, is they'd just shuttle backwards and forwards in one local area. Now they've zoned it, and you've got to be out of that zone, and you've got to stay out of that zone for a period of time. And that's actually very unpopular with quite a number of people who live on the canals and rivers as continuous cruisers. But the people who are in charge of our canals say that it's absolutely necessary. So
I know you're the editor of a well-respected, award-winning financial website. Why on earth do you know so much about that topic? That is weird.
Well, because every so often throughout the years you get an article about living on a canal boat rather than in a house.
Are you suggesting you rehash old stories?
If you read enough of these and you edit enough of these and you write enough of these, I've written them in. When I started on This Is Money, property was my speciality 11 years ago. Over the years,
it all becomes clear.
You write a number of these articles, you research it. And also, my friend who's considering living in a tiny house has, of course, considered living in a canal boat.
Naturally. Who hasn't? Editor Simon Lambert and development editor Rich Browning.